Welcome to the Cigar Thoughts broadcast. I'm Jackson Bevins, writer over at fieldgoals.com. With me this week are my editor, Danny Kelly. Thanks for coming on.
Yeah, man. Thanks for having me.
And Brent Cole, editor-in-chief of What's Up Magazine.
How's it going?
Kind of the premier music and entertainment magazine around here. So happy to have you both back with me. We're going to do this show the way we did last week. A lot of good feedback on that. So three of us are going to talk about Rams game and what it means. And then we are going to have Matt and Isaac back on per your request to break down exactly what happened with the offensive line as they got shredded by the Rams. And we'll finish with a roundtable discussing just the outlook looking forward. So glad to have you back with us. And Danny, I want to start with you.
Sure.
That game had a really weird feeling to it.
Yeah.
How would you describe watching that game, and what was jumping out to you?
Well, they got really, and you know they always talk about being on schedule. They got really off schedule. Mm-hmm. Like, it started immediately. The first two plays were runs that got blown up for like 5 yards lost. Their first drive went for negative 5 yards. On their next offensive series, I believe that was when they did the fumble return for a touchdown. And so immediately they're down 10-0. And the game plan kind of gets thrown out the window. And and we'll talk about this later, Isaac and Matt will, but the offensive line just wasn't getting any push. They weren't protecting. Kind of went back to, it felt exactly like the Seahawks of earlier in the season where Russell Wilson was scrambling around.
Like the last time that we played the Rams.
Right, yeah. Yeah. And, they didn't have any rhythm on offense. Russell Wilson looked skittish back there. He played all right, considering. And I think the defense actually played all right, all things considered. There was like, they had like 207 total yards. But they just kept giving them short fields. John Ryan had a couple bad punts, mm-hmm. or at least one.
At least two.
And I don't know, it was just kind of one of those things where everything that could have gone wrong did. You know what I mean? It was the Murphy's Law game. I don't know what the deal was, but they just, the Rams. I hate the Rams.
Yeah. Yeah, I just wish that they could be the Rams when they played the Seahawks. Our friend Jono described it perfectly. He says they are the paper to the Seahawks rock, and most of the league is scissors. And I was just like, that's perfect. That's the best way that I can describe it. Brent, what was your main takeaway from watching that game?
Well, it was the kind of that off game you hear of, so it's the norm that every team has an off game. Even the very, very, very best teams have the off games. But we haven't had the off game in, not like this, in 4 years. So it was disconcerting how shitty it was from just one bad center snap. Multiple. I mean, and Tristan Michael getting 6 yards on 6 carries, and not it being his fault.
Right, he was getting hit.
Yeah, it was just everything that seemed to go wrong. Richard Sherman gave up the touchdown. I mean, everything that could go wrong did. And so on one hand, you look at it and say, well, Jesus, the Packers, got their ass kicked.
Patriots lost.
The Patriots lost. I mean,
Steelers.
Steelers. I mean, you can go down the list. All these teams lost. The loss. Some of them got beat really bad. We played the worst game I've really seen them play in years, and we lost by 6. So that's a good thing. It was disconcerting because this is not what our Seahawks team does.
Right. So let me ask you guys this, and either you feel free to answer. Was that a fluky win?
By the Rams?
Yeah.
No, I mean, I don't think it was fluky. The Rams, and this is kind of what's been talked about a lot after the game. It's like the Rams are really built to beat teams like Seattle. They match up really well. I think in this game, because a lot of people talk about how the Rams are kind of dirty and headhunting and things like that, but they played Seahawks-style ball, and the fact that they were dislodging the football from receivers. There was like 5 or 6... I don't know if that's maybe 3 or 4 plays where receivers had the ball in their hands and they got hit hard and dropped it. And that's clean, good, like a great football play. That's what we love about the Seahawks for the last couple of years. They did that, and obviously they got beat up on the offensive line. I think it was just a matter of the Rams just, you know, played their game. And it, going back years, the last 4 years, it seems like the Rams games are always like this. It's there's maybe one blowout in the whole time. It's always a real battle. So, no, I don't think it's fluky. I think it's just the Seahawks didn't play well, and they made a lot of mistakes. It just came down to they made a lot of mistakes.
But that's the part, you know, that I found most disconcerting is the amount of mistakes, the amount that they just seemed off. Like, they weren't up for the game. And that's just not something that the Seahawks do.
Right.
I mean, they gave up a 21-0 to Tampa Bay at halftime a couple of years. I mean, those things happen. But they just felt like, from the beginning, it was a, fuck it, kind of game. And that's a wild exaggeration. Nobody's thinking that. But they didn't have the sharp focus that they always seem to have. And while it's a trap game, all these, you know, you can go through all the things, and like we just mentioned, teams lose big all the time, lo-de-do-de-do, the lack of focus was disconcerting. And you heard Softy Mahler talking afterwards, that the locker room seemed really off. You heard Pete Carroll the next day, or Pete Carroll's press conference right afterwards was 5 minutes.
Yeah, that was weird.
The interview the next day with Brock and Salk was not
that was his, short.
It was short and not jovial. He's not kidding around. There was a sense of
probably a rough tell the truth Monday.
Yeah, something was amiss, and I think something was more amiss than I think anybody was prepared for.
I want to rephrase because when you ask that, I don't think it was a fluke that the Rams won. I will say I think it was an outlier to the way the Seahawks played, if that makes sense.
Saying it was a fluke.
Jesus, Dan, decide what you're going to do.
What I'm saying is I want to give the Rams credit for
physically
kicking the Seahawks' asses, because they really
did.
So it's crazy, right? Because and I texted Danny during Cigar Thoughts this week. This was the most difficult article I've had to write, and not because, you know, some existential crisis that was revealed by it, but simply because the whole game had this gross, squishy feel to it. Mm-hmm. The whole day did, and then it was like this wonky, weird, outlier game with all kinds of stuff happening. No doubt, Rams up front own the Seahawks, but the drops, the dropped interceptions, the snaps going all over the place,
the
fumbling five times. I mean, some of that is just circumstantial, whatever. I mean,
when does a center ever recover? Right? To
no, it's got to be the first time ever. And
unbelievable.
But so here's the thing. You have part of that is kind of this fluky thing, and the other thing that made it so difficult is this didn't change the narrative of the Seahawks for me very much, and we can get to that later. But I look at that, and they got beat up front.
Yep.
And it seems like, the defense was kind of off. I mean, Richard Sherman, that was probably the worst play of Richard Sherman's career.
Yeah.
It just happened to fall on this game, right? Not one where they're up by 29 points. It just happened, right? That's twice that touchdown passes against the Seahawks.
It was the weirdest play, too, because it came, it felt like it came right after the commercial. All of a sudden, it was just like, oh.
It was one play drive. And so you look at that game, you're like, wow, the Rams scored 23 points. But then you look at how they scored 23 points. And one was a 25-yard drive that got him a field goal. One was that 28-yard touchdown. So they only had to go 28 for that one. Their second touchdown was a fumble recovery, so that's not on the Seahawks defense.
Yeah.
And then the other one, they had one sustained drive, and it was 11 plays for 62 yards, and 30 of them didn't count because they were fumbles forward that they somehow got. Like, the Rams didn't successfully sustain a drive one time that entire game and won. So it's weird because I do want to give the Rams credit for winning up front, but nothing about that game makes me think that the Seahawks aren't still a vastly superior team. Like, the Rams had to dominate up front and had to have all of this other stuff. I mean, the Seahawks lost all four reviews in that game. You know, there were some big plays. That last Russell Wilson fumble was
you know, devastating.
Yeah.
And all of that had to happen for it to only be a 6-win game. So, in a way, I was a little bit encouraged by the fact that, okay, if they are going to lose to the Rams, it didn't seem to me to expose any major chinks in the armor.
Except for we didn't touch the Rams quarterback.
That was weird.
At all.
That was weird.
And so there were chinks in the armor. I think it was that the Rams were playing just not quite as shitty as we were. But it's not like they played great, you know. But back to, you know, Michael Bennett. And then it felt also like it was like a war. Would they have 4 or 5 guys out with concussion protocol early?
Mm-hmm.
Yeah. You know, we had guys going out. Michael Bennett's only running at 70%. It felt the whole damn thing just felt like, fine, you guys win, we'll lose. Let's call it at halftime.
It's like trench warfare.
Yeah, exactly. Mm-hmm. So nobody else gets killed. You know, I've never seen Russell Wilson get up grabbing his leg as he's walking to the huddle. And it just, the whole thing felt wrong. I guess that's the best way I could say it.
I think the thing that matters in this game, too, is, and this doesn't, I don't know if it's been talked about a lot, but they were down to their final tight end in the game.
Yeah, huge.
If you go back a couple years, you might remember the Seahawks played in Chicago in the playoffs, and they lost John mm-hmm. Carlson mm-hmm. after, like, in the first quarter.
Yep.
And it totally fucked up their whole game plan because I don't think they had anybody after him. And so you basically have to take away almost all your plays that have a tight end in there. And they tried to do it with Cooper Helfitt, and he had a bad game.
Yeah.
I mean, you're asking him to block William Hayes.
You're asking him to be something he's not.
Yeah, and so, like, this really threw their game plan out of whack, I think.
I wasn't even aware of that during the game.
McCoy was inactive or on the IR.
He's on IR now.
Jimmy Graham's gone, obviously. Luke Wilson left with a concussion.
Yeah.
And that left Helfitt. Do they even have another tight end on their roster?
They have Chase. But I think he was inactive.
He was inactive, I believe, too.
Flex Gilliam back out there and throw in your...
So they were like, they were running Jean-Pierre on like a motion.
Yeah.
Like, it was weird. So like that really fucked up their whole game.
And with Okung out, they didn't have the ability to use Bailey, which they had been using
So they were like, it was a battle of attrition out there, and they lost it. And I mean, I think the whole Helfitt thing mattered because, like I said, then you really kind of limit your play calling. And it, like, even when you do have tight ends out there, he's just not very good. I mean, he's good in a very small role, what they ask him to do, but he had a drop, I think. He had, blown block. I mean, I don't know. I didn't see anything really that good from him out there. And so, I don't know. It was just, I think that was a big factor. And they're a running team. And they, you know, want to run. And so they have
first
a lot of time
in
sets.
26 games where they didn't rush for 100 yards as a team.
So, and I was writing a quick game recap, and they ended up scoring a touchdown with 17 seconds left. So it kind of changed the narrative a little bit. But that would have been the first time they'd lost by more than 10 points in like 3 years. It was the first time in 25 games they hadn't rushed for 100 yards. They lost the turnover battle 3-0.
And first time in 64 games that they never held a lead.
There you go. That's the other one.
That's a record that will probably never get touched.
Yeah. And that was just, so everything about that game was just like, I mean, it was just bad. But to go along with what you were saying earlier, it didn't change my opinion about the Seahawks, to be honest. You know, I think they're still who they are. If they can get a little bit more healthy, they'll be in good shape. They're still missing Cam Chancellor. They're still missing, you know, Michael Bennett's not himself right now.
Russell Okung. Now
you're missing your starting strong safety, who's an All-Pro.
Right.
Your left tackle. Your main pass rush is not healthy.
I'm sorry to interrupt, the offensive line has really built this year on continuity because they haven't necessarily built it on talent. It's been scheme and being able to work together. Well, all of a sudden you took out one of the biggest cogs, the biggest aspects of it. So that's going to absolutely screw up the continuity of the whole thing. But the thing is, we look at all these different things, we have all these different excuses, but it also just felt like they didn't come out with that Seahawks fire And that's the part that is disconcerting to me.
Yeah, I think there is something to that. And it's so crazy because, you know, you get it if this was how it was with the 49ers. And, you know, for a three-year stretch, you knew that every game of 49ers is going to be a tussle. But they had quarterbacks who were playing really well at the time, right? You had Alex Smith, who just every year we keep expecting him to just be a bad quarterback. And every year he's a good quarterback. Colin Kaepernick was playing very well for the first 2.5 years of his career. And so that's one thing. With the Rams, you look at the quarterbacks that have beat the Seahawks. We're talking Case Keenum, Nick Foles, Austin Davis, Sam Bradford. These are not good NFL quarterbacks. So to me, that's just adds, and it doesn't mean anything because you're not going to see any quarterbacks like that in the playoffs. It's just so bizarre. It just adds to the weirdness of this rivalry in that those quarterbacks shouldn't stand a chance. Their team shouldn't even be in the game, you know, when it comes to playing a team like the Seahawks. But every time they are, you know, four mediocre quarterbacks have beat the Seahawks.
I found it interesting, too, that, I mean, how many games have they lost at home?
They lost three this year.
Yeah, more than they had in 3 years combined.
Yeah, this was the place you went into. You were going to lose if you knew
they're invincible.
Yeah, 8-0, maybe 7-1 if someone went shit it out. But they were invincible at home.
27-2 counting playoffs at home over the previous
two
years.
And those are the kinds of things that worry me, not the Michael Bennett's toe or Cam Chancellor or some of the other things. It's that the mojo that we were feeling so good about 2 weeks ago maybe was in part because of the teams that they were playing against.
Yeah, I mean, it could be, and it's so hard. We talked about this last week. They've only beat one team this year that's currently projected to make the playoffs. Right? I mean, that's what it is. It was the Vikings. And Danny and I do a NFL Picks podcast every week. And whenever the Vikings come up, I always kind of throw shade their way. I think they're paper tigers. So they beat the Steelers, who are legit. I think the Steelers are a very good team, but they probably won't make the playoffs. I can't see the Vikings making it out of the first round. So what I need to see as a Seahawks fan is, can this team beat a contender? Can this 2015 team beat a contender quality team? And they haven't, right? I mean, they lost to the Cardinals, they lost to the Panthers, they lost to the Bengals. Those are teams that are top eight, have a shot at it. And that's why I think this week is going to be really, really important. And I was glad to see that the Panthers lost and the Cardinals won, because I wanted this game to mean something to Arizona, because I want Seattle to play. I don't want them to beat Arizona's backups. I want them to go out, win or lose. I don't care if they're 5 or 6.
But I also don't want them to go into the playoffs at 9-7.
It doesn't matter, though.
Oh, for fuck's sake. It really,
what's the difference between 9-7 and 10-6?
Man, I remember growing up to those 9-7 teams that you're like, oh God, just barely.
But you're in, though, right?
Playoffs.
Yeah,
you're in. I understand, but I just, for me, a 9-7 reminds me of the bad days where you're just squeaking in.
Yeah,
and this is a team that needs to come in with some fire, because they're going to go up against such incredible, obviously, competition.
Yeah, we'll get to that a little bit later on. We're going to take a quick break and bring in Isaac and Matt and kind of really break down what happened in the trenches. We've talked about that domination, and we're going to see exactly how it went down in a minute. So we'll catch up with you in a few seconds. We're back here at the Cigar Thoughts podcast in downtown Bellingham at the Glow Nightclub. Joining me right now, you know him, Matt Nichols, former All-Conference offensive lineman at Pacific Lutheran University, helped him win a national championship. And joining us for the second consecutive week is his teammate, fellow offensive lineman at PLU, captain of the team, Isaac Williams. Thank you for coming back on. So the audience really dug learning O-line from you guys. And I wanted to bring you guys back because last week, you know, it was kind of a soft landing for you guys, because the offensive line had been playing so well, and it's easy to point out the highlights and how everything is coming together. They got their butts kicked this week, to my lazy eye, and I kind of want to hear from you guys what it is that you saw. So, Isaac, I want to start with you. What was the first thing, or even better, the main thing that jumped out to you as you watched the Seahawks offensive line play?
Well, they just, I mean, within the first two or three plays, I mean, it was very apparent that they were just outgunned talent-wise. And that's, we talked last week about how important it is to be cohesive and have that sense of where each other is going, where each person is going to be, so on and so forth. And, you know, if that stuff hasn't come together, or if you're just so outgunned, man, they were outgunned, and they just got manhandled.
So was it just a talent thing?
Yes.
Okay.
Yes. And one of the things that Isaac and I were talking about with this game is, if you're playing against a Carolina or you're playing against another defense that has a very good players, like Carolina will have a good D-line, and then Luke Kuechly and their linebackers are good, but you can scheme for that. When you're out-athleted across the board on the D-line versus offensive line, there's not a lot you can do, especially when we are a zone blocking team and everything that we do in the running game is based on movement and moving our offensive line. When those D linemen are comfortable moving laterally and are better athletes than you, it makes for a really long day. And especially when you get guys that are so freakishly athletic that they can make plays all over the field because they run. Plus, what they're able to do is they're able to rotate guys in fresh, so they're bringing in Nick Fairley off of the bench, and they're bringing – they didn't even have Quinn for the game. I mean, they have dudes upon dudes upon dudes to play there. And when you have your five offensive line and then you go out, your starting tight end, who's actually your backup tight end, you're without your starting left tackle, it makes for a long day.
And truly, that left tackle was probably the only guy – that could have sort of washed out one of those guys. I wouldn't say he's better than those guys, but at the same time, he could have been kind of a guy on a guy.
Fought to a drop.
Yeah. Absolutely.
Yeah.
And then, because, I mean, it was, I saw those, the D linemen playing off of guys getting into their legs like linebackers. Mm-hmm. I mean, you just don't see, I mean, they just are so athletic that it just, I mean, they are our kryptonite. That group for our O-line. That group is our kryptonite.
Okay, so to that point then, is that just, hey, this is how it's going to be for the next 5 years, twice a year, the Seahawks offensive line is just going to get their butts whooped like that? Or is, I mean, is that talent differential insurmountable? And follow-up question, is it insurmountable from a schematic standpoint?
No.
Because some teams score a lot of points on the Rams.
Yeah. No, it's not insurmountable. Are we going to see this? Again, this gets back to we're outmanned at our offensive line versus their defensive line. But we shot ourselves in the foot and then turned around and shot off the other foot and then turned around and put the gun to our head and pulled the trigger.
Right.
Like, this was a shotgun snap that goes over our quarterback's head. Thank God Kristen Michaels is back there to grab it. This is Will Tufuaku fumbling a ball. There were so many little things that happened. Two false starts by Alvin Bailey, a clip block by Alvin Bailey. There were so many little things that got us off schedule, off rhythm, that when you're going against a team that has unbelievable athletes and they have a coach who, let's be honest, runs some crazy stuff defensively. I mean, he'll do some bring four aside, he'll bring some exotic blitzes with nickel corner blitzes, stuff like that. He just does so much that when you're off schedule, when you're not in a second and six or a third and three and you're in that second and 14, it is a nightmare for us. And it probably is a nightmare for most teams.
So let me narrow down that question, because I think you're right and agree with you on all counts.
Good.
Narrowing that question down to the offensive line versus the defensive line, is that, I mean, let's say, you know, the Seahawks stop messing up their snaps and they catch their passes and recover their fumbles and all of that evens out, right? That's what's going to happen. I'm talking is because the Seahawks do zone blocking and because it's a bunch of guys playing unnatural positions versus a bunch of guys who have been the best in the world the entire lives at every age level at their natural positions, is that matchup differential insurmountable over the next 5 years? Will they always lose that offensive line versus defensive line?
No.
In my opinion, I mean, even next year, even take the same group of guys, if you bring back Russell Okung, you bring back some of the weapons that we have, you bring back a Marshawn Lynch, the first half of the game goes differently. We're not in 2nd and 14, 3rd and 14. You know, you're in some tolerable downs, down in distances. I mean, even the same groups. It's a bad matchup that went horribly wrong on top of being a bad matchup. So, no. You've got a lot of guys who, on our side, who are quite athletic, who will still continue to develop. It's not freak out and it's the end of the world or anything. It's just, yeah, we were outgunned and you can work with that, but
struggled. And in 5 years from now, are the St. Louis Rams going to still have that kind of D-line rotation in next year? Are they going to have
special group.
This is one of those once-in-a-lifetime groups where you're like, holy crap, there is so much talent there.
15 years from now, we're going to be like, can you believe all of those guys used to be on the same team?
Yeah, yeah. And you're going to see them. It's like the Seahawks DB room from a few years ago.
Sure, right.
Where we're looking at it and you're like, holy crap, there's never been a better DB room in the history of the NFL than the Seahawks had in, 2012 or 2013?
Yep.
And now these guys are all over the league. There's playmakers everywhere. It's going to be the same with this Rams D-line because you cannot re-sign all of those under a salary cap system.
Yep.
So that is not going to be the issue.
Ndamukong Suh is the friend of many of those fellows.
Yeah.
They're going to make a lot of money because of Ndamukong Suh.
Exactly.
And going forward, you know, as we progress, if we continue into the playoffs and farther, the cool thing is we're not going to have to deal with that again. You'll have some horses, but at the same time, we at least can fight to a draw across the front and then deal with some of the guys.
So. Yeah.
All right, rank as best as you can the five potential playoff opponents for the Seahawks in terms of just their front line, front seven, whatever. Mm-hmm. Cardinals, Panthers, Packers, Vikings, Redskins.
I'm going to go Carolina, probably one. The Cardinals, two. Vikings, if healthy, mm-hmm. are up there,
yep.
three. You know, after that, you're looking at Redskins, Packers.
Sounds like you're not worried about Redskins and Packers defensive fronts.
Not to say that you're not worried about them. But I think Carolina's D-line and Arizona's with Calais Campbell and the schemes. Again, a lot of it is not just the players, but the scheme that they run as well. Where, let's go back to Arizona last year, where they run some funky-ass blitz, but they put Larry Foote man-to-man coverage on Luke Wilson, and he torches them for touchdowns. So that's all part of it. They are willing to gamble, and they're still willing to gamble, even with Todd Bowles, their defensive coordinator last year, now with the Jets. So they are willing to do stuff like that, where Carolina's like, we're going to play base defense and come at us, fuckers. Yeah. Like, do what you want to do.
Yeah.
Which is exactly what Seattle does, too. It's like, we're better than you. You go 80 yards and you score a touchdown, congratulations. You're not going to do it four times in a game. You can go at 60 and we'll hold you to field goals all game long. Carolina's built that same way, where it's like, you want to run sideline to sideline? What is it? Davis and Keekly?
Yeah.
We'll run sideline to sideline with you. You want to throw deep? We got Josh Norman there. Roman Harper is 127 years old, and he's still a good safety.
Still doing it.
He's the only person I've ever seen with that much gray hair in the NFL that's not a punter or a kicker, and he's really, really good.
Yeah.
And they'll just sit in their 4-3 defense and be like, come at us, which I love. And, so as far as athletic D lines, there's nobody like the Rams that we will match up against.
When we say, and in my opinion at least, when you say here's Carolina, the seven involved with St. Louis is, I mean, it's not, in my opinion, it's not even, they're just
St. Louis is that
St. Louis, they're just so athletic.
God, man, how is it that you can give Jeff Fisher 4-win talent or 12-win talent and he's going to deliver 7 or 8 wins every single time?
He is like, incredibly mediocre.
It's amazing, but he's like impossible to fire, right? Like he's like the youth pastor. You're not going to get rid of him.
Yeah, no, it's totally true.
He's not great, but he's not going to... causing any trouble.
Yeah, I think that may be the first time in history that Jeff Fisher was compared to a youth pastor. Just say,
I did like to throw backwards baseball cap.
He's got the goatee that says he's edgy but safe. You know,
he's got a puncher that'll cheap shot guys in the back. There's growing up in Seattle, and I know you both are baseball fans. Isaac also played baseball in college. You played baseball in college. Pedro Martinez to the Mariners was like the Rams D to Seattle.
Yeah.
And Pedro, where it didn't matter how good the Mariners teams were, if you got 4 hits on him, awesome. And that was it. Like, it would be an hour and 57-minute game. It'd be 3-0. and he's thrown 100 pitches maybe and barely broken a sweat, and it's like game over.
Yeah.
It's that kind of matchup where it just – the talent that they have there is just so good, and it's just so much better than what we've – than what we've gone against all year and what we'll see it going forward.
And where that gets scary is if they've got Arizona's offense to go with that defense, that's terrifying.
Yeah.
You know, Arizona has – their front seven is certainly not as good, but they're just much more balanced. They've got the offense to go with the defense. I mean, you give the Rams a potent offense to go with that, that's a problem.
Yeah.
So the sad thing about all of this is even as bad as all that was, you know, with good old Case Keenum rolling up 208 yards of total offense and basically us having to give up a defensive touchdown run up, it all came together in the way that it had to for us to lose.
Yeah. It just didn't seem like that formula was repeatable, right? Like, yes, they won all up front, and if they played again next week, they'd win up front again.
Yeah.
But just so much stuff had to happen.
Well, I mean, let's go back to, like, the first series where we started the 10-yard line. We have a run or a pass that's incomplete. Wilson throws it high to Lockett. We try a run, get nothing. Then we get a false start by Bailey. So that backs us up again. The next drive, we get the snap over Russell's head to Kristen Michaels. That gets us off schedule. I mean, it was just all of these little things. And I think there was one play when we talk about how athletic these guys are that I thought stood out probably more than anything. And it was after the Rams have gone up 10-0, we get the ball back, and we're starting to move the ball. We get a 3rd-and-5 situation. And Seattle this year has done something that is really cool that you don't see many teams in the NFL do, where they'll put 4 receivers on one side of the field and put 1 on the other. So they got 5 receivers, but they're going 4 to one side in a diamond formation on this play and 1 to the backside. And what they're doing right there is they're trying to see exactly what the defense is doing, because if you're in man coverage, you can't double-team this backside. He's got an ISO. If you're in a zone coverage, you can't. You don't have numbers over with the 4 receiver side. And we did a play in college where it was the exact same formations. It was bunch numbers, where if there was 2 defenders over there, we had 3 guys to block it, throw it to the back guy, the diamond, and let him run. Seattle does that same thing, and Alvin Bailey goes to cut the left end, Sims, and Sims literally pushes him down and runs to the sideline and tackles Tyler Lockett for a 4-yard gain on a beautifully thrown ball to Russell Wilson that is blocked beautifully by Luke Wilson and the receivers up front. There are no DNs that make that play. There are probably 3 people in the NFL that can make that play, and sure enough, he stops him for a 4-yard gain. There's nothing like that, and I hope we can throw a video of it in the comment section, because when I watched it, I was like, dude, good for you. That's phenomenal. Because
we talked last week about that the zone blocking scheme and trying to get all these bodies moving laterally and all that, which works really well against 320-pound dudes. The problem, the kryptonite to that is all of a sudden when you get this fast-flowing, moving thing, and all of a sudden the guys that are fast-flowing, you know, it's almost like the Seahawks and the Broncos back in the Super Bowl, where all of a sudden they're better at doing what you're trying to do, and they take it away. They penetrate.
They play off of your cut block.
They just play off like linebackers.
Those D linemen and linebackers had such good hands that when you're throwing a cut block, and cut blocking is not hard to do, but where you aim at and where you target has to be specific. And again, it's right here in the thigh area. But it has to be in front of the guy in the direction that he's going for you to be able to get there and then roll against the grain. Because you always want to roll back into him to get that cutting action. And they are able to, as the guy is going, to literally push the offensive lineman down, hop over him, and make plays. And
so when you're getting just out man like that, I mean, that's just... They're getting served regularly, right? And I don't know if you guys ever just went up against someone that just kicked your butt all day long, right? Mm-hmm. Okay. So when that happens, does it get in your head? And are you more at risk of skipping out on fundamentals and missing things because of that? Because it seemed to me like not only were they getting out athleticized, but just structurally they looked broken on the offensive line.
Kind of my take on all of that would be, so the zone blocking scheme is difficult. They're out athleticing them doing that. It actually, in my opinion, would probably be easier to have a man blocking scheme against those athletic dudes, because then you could communicate with one another and play angles that you can't play with a zone blocking scheme. So even if you're more athletic than I am, I can talk to my buddy and say, hey, let's change how we're going to block this. You block down on him, and I'll pull around you and kick out the other guy, and we'll play these angles.
Yeah.
that also then gets in their head because they don't know then, you know, if I'm a D lineman, I'm like, all right, they're either going to probably block at a 45-degree angle that way or whatever it is. I kind of know what's coming.
Yeah.
So where you can get into that man-blocking system and they're like, oh, so is he going to block me straight up? Is somebody going to block down on me?
Am I going to get trapped by a backside guard?
So they don't know, you know, where is this coming? So it then all of a sudden makes them hesitate and puts them at a disadvantage that way. So where the zone blocking system is awesome against some teams, big, not as mobile, you know, big, thick Vince Wilfork, though he's pretty athletic for the size that he is, types of guys. The man schemes are a lot more successful, frankly, against some of the more, in my opinion, the more athletic.
I agree. So is it possible then? I mean, you can't just switch. You can't teach them zone block all year and be like, hey, we're playing the Rams.
And that's switching. Tom Cable's credit. I mean, frankly, in my opinion, partially how he's so successful taking folks that have hardly played a lot of offensive line is by saying, hey, y'all, it's not really that complicated. Now, granted, it's complicated, but as opposed to having to learn all these different cross blocks and adjust, you can implement a pretty quick battle strategy by saying this is what we're going to do and be athletic. And
if you go back to Beastquake 2, that run, they actually pulled J.R. Sweezy from the backside. They had four guys lined up on the right, so they had center, guard, tackle, tight end, and they actually pull Sweezy back. And so they have that in their playbook, and they have done that before. But that is not something that you can do play after play after play.
Yeah, yeah.
That has to be a changeup to a fastball. That can't be an every play thing. So it's there, but when you're down and you have a backup left tackle, I mean, the last week against Cleveland, we saw them using Alvin Bailey as that sixth offensive lineman. We saw in the Will Tufuaku fumble that it was Lemuel Jean-Pierre in there. They're doing things that are them, but when you don't have your normal people in their normal positions against something like that, it's going to be a cluster.
One of the things Danny talked about in the first segment I thought was really interesting because I didn't notice it during the game was that when Luke Wilson was concussed, they left them with one tight end. Mm-hmm. And a tight end who is a pick your spots, have him do a few things once in a while guy who now not only has to be a 60 down tight end but do it against these guys. How much does that affect the rest of the line? Is there a domino effect in that kind of situation?
Yes, because the D coordinator can scheme against to get who they want to rush against that tight end in pass situations. A good defensive coordinator will say, all right, I'm going to line up somebody on the – so let's say the tight end's to the right. On the defensive right, the offensive left, we'll line up a D tackle shaded on side of the center. We'll put somebody on – the guard, somebody on the tackle, and then we'll blitz off at the end. Yeah. And if you do something like that, that tight end has to pick up. Yeah. If he's staying in to pass block, he has to pick up that blitzer. Yeah. So you have a guy that's not a good pass blocker trying to block somebody that's coming at a running start against them. And it's a losing battle. He's not a Zach Miller blocker. He's not even a Luke Wilson blocker. So it's really unfair for him to be in that position because that's not what he's on the roster to do. But because of the necessity of only having two tight ends and Luke down, he was forced to be in that position. A defensive coordinator can scheme to get that all the time.
The minute they see it, I mean, it's like blood in the water. They're like, all right, we're going to make Cooper Huff block a guy one-on-one by how we align.
Yeah.
Okay. Yeah, no, that makes sense.
And poor Cooper Huff, it wasn't fair.
R.I.P.
Yeah. Did you? I mean, he gave up a sack.
He did. He rode him as long as he could. And then he just couldn't cut off the inside.
He probably cut off on the camera view, but afterwards he slapped his hand together and did this, and I was like, oh, now they know he knows, and he knows they know, and it was rough, man.
Yeah.
Poor Cooper.
Yeah.
It'll be good.
So one of the things that I remember Rex Ryan talking about when he was with Baltimore, and Baltimore had those great defenses over the years with Ray Lewis, and I mean just talent on talent, is that when he was scheming against an offense, he would always look for what their blocking systems was, whether it's run or pass, how they incorporated tight ends, how they incorporated running backs, and to see what their fundamental structure is and what if they moved to a slide protection, if they just had a straight man blocking protection in pass. And then from there, what are the weaknesses of it and how to break it down. So with Cooper Helfitt being out there on an island with a DN, that's something that Greg Williams has had in place all week long. And he was just looking for the opportunity to take advantage of Luke Wilson or Cooper Helfitt or whoever was in there at that time period. That's something that any D coordinator and every D coordinator does by Tuesday of the week is they already have that plan into place.
Okay, so in a situation like that, then, so you've, like I said, Cooper Helfand, he's a package player, right? He's mm-hmm. in on specific packages, take advantage of specific matchups. When he's in there for 50-plus plays now, does that... I know it thins an offensive playbook, right? I know it does. But to what degree does something as simple as being down to your third-string specialist tight end thin out a Daryl Bevell playbook?
We can talk about this from personal example in college where our coordinator would have, you know when you watch the...
Your coordinator was something special, too.
And we had a playbook that I doubt anybody in Division III had more plays than us. I doubt many teams in Division... I know nobody in Division I had what we did because you had to be above and beyond intelligent.
If you're not familiar with the PLU football program in the 90s and 2000s, Scott Western was the offensive coordinator, and that offense produced at outrageous rates with undersized yeah. offensive linemen and everything. So you're talking about taking advantage of guys who maybe aren't prototypical for their positions. Yeah. These guys know that yeah. offense. So I just want to put that out there. That
our junior year at PLU, we won the national championship. Our senior year at PLU, we graduated a ton of players. I moved from backup tackle to starting center that year. We started... What, three new offensive linemen? We lost an All-American running back. We lost good wide receivers. That following year, our senior year, we were number two in all of Division III in yards per game, and we missed one by 1 yard a game. And there were numbers of games in which, in the third quarter, Isaac and I are loosening up our shoulder pads because we're not going back in, and the backups are in, and then the third strings are in, and guys that were four strings are going in. We put up prolific numbers there. So when you lose a player, or you lose in this situation, they're down Jimmy Graham, they're down Luke Wilson, they now have yeah. their third tight end, who is truly a specialist for package plays.
Yeah.
The offensive coordinator, with his plan, will literally take his pen and go, nope. And he will cross off huge chunks of plays, yeah. because whether it's a tight end middle screen or a tight end seam route because Cooper's not fast enough to run that or whatever it is, those will all literally get crossed off. And so his playbook that has gone from hundreds of plays has been cut down by dozens of plays.
This just underscores my annoyance with just lazily blaming things on the coordinator, right? You have a series of injuries that maybe a third of the playbook is gone now.
So yeah, one. So and remember, so it wasn't just Cooper Helfand. So mm-hmm. Wilson's out.
Yep.
You've got
Lockett gone for part of time. So you have a backup left tackle.
Okung's yep. So not only are you like, okay, here's the section for our normal tight end being out. Now where we've got our tackle section out. So as soon as
Daryl Bevell is just
slicing off pieces of the playbook and moving them aside,
and
just saying, and then as guys are going under concussion protocol, those are cutting out more and more stuff out. So, you mean, functionally, there's no idea to know, but he may have only been working off of how many plays, do you think?
60% of the playbook?
Yeah,
absolutely. I mean, legitimately. Plus, and you have Kaysen Williams on the active roster, who just yeah. gets promoted the day before,
exactly
who probably through all, since preseason, has probably been running scout squad the whole time. So now you're trying to incorporate him in on the few plays in which he knows to give Baldwin a break because his hammy is hurt, yeah. to give Lockett time to get back from concussion protocol, to give Jermaine breaks. I mean, all of this is interworking. This is not college where you can have new guys flooding in. You got 47, and that's it.
Third down and critical at a crucial time in the game, and I'd like to run this, but I can't. And I'd like to run that, what I can't, but I'd like to run this. Well, I guess this is the cleaner shirt in the dirty line, and we better try this. You know, yeah. And you hear them say, my job as a coach is to put them in the best position I can to be successful. I mean, they're not just saying that. They want to put the guys in the best position they possibly can to be successful. And you got to try and weigh, do I want to ask this of Cooper Helfand or not, or do I want to ask this of Bailey or not? And then, now it's one thing if it's Ferndale High School or PLU. It's another thing when you got a quarterback that you're paying that amount of money to where you're like, well, I want to run this play, but if this doesn't work out,
sure,
our investment, the future,
yeah,
is at risk.
That is wild.
Yeah, it is. And one of the things that Pete has done is foster that environment for Tom Cable and Daryl Bevell to work in unison together to put it. And we've always seen Seattle has been a phenomenal second half team. And even in this game, they were better in the second half yeah. than they were in the first half because they were able to make adjustments. But when you're going into a gunfight and you got a six shooter and they got a machine gun, that's a hard fight to win. The NFL does a great job of getting teams close to parity with taking the 53-man roster and going it to 47 on game day. Yeah. And then concussion protocols and then this and this and this. That talent gap, because I really believe that Seattle has a more talented roster than the Rams,
sure,
has narrowed. Yeah. And then it gets even closer and closer. And we've talked all season about the 2% difference in teams.
You got it.
We saw it in this game.
You got it.
The yep. ball on the ground where a center recovers it twice. Will Tufuaku, who has really good hands, fumbling a ball and they get running back for a touchdown. All of these little things.
You have to win the weird sometimes.
Yeah.
And the Rams dominated the weird in this game. You know.
Yeah.
So, I think there's a lot to that. I appreciate you guys kind of breaking that out. I didn't even realize how big the domino effect to an injury like someone like Luke Wilson is. So, appreciate that. We're going to take a quick break. We're going to bring Danny and Brent back on. We're going to talk about the Seahawks season moving forward. So, I'll let you guys go get a refill as well, and we'll see you in a little bit. Cigar Thoughts arm wrestling competition. On one side we have Isaac and Matt. On the other we have
so we're
gonna throw down right here over the top style. Now this is for the third segment. We're gonna bring back the roundtable format, and I want to get your guys' thoughts. First of all, before looking ahead too much, there's kind of a weird game this week, right? Because it looked, going into this last week, it looked like this game wasn't going to mean anything for the Cardinals. And then going into today or yesterday, it looked like it probably still wasn't going to mean anything from the Cardinals, because the Panthers are hosting the Buccaneers in what was supposed to be a morning game. So ostensibly, the Cardinals would know at kickoff or early into the game whether or not they had a shot at the one seed. But the Panthers got flexed to the afternoon, which means the Seahawks are going to see the Cardinals' best shot. And I personally am really, really happy about that. I don't want the Seahawks to go and just beat the backups and have the Cardinals not put anything on film.
Beaten by the backups.
Right. Yeah, well, that's right. Yeah, sure.
Right.
Sort of lose-lose there, I guess. But for me, what I need to see to really feel like this team can compete for a championship the way the last three seasons they've been able to is, can this team beat a top eight team, a top four team in the NFL? And the Cardinals at full strength at home are a top four team. They might be a top one team.
Yeah.
And so that's what I'm excited to see. Win or lose, I want to see, especially if Okung is back, especially if Chancellor is back, especially if Lynch is back, as close to full strength as they'll be the rest of the way. That's what I want to see.
But you just said, especially if Okung is back, especially if Chancellor's back. I have no insight particularly other than really?
I didn't know this.
That Russ and Okung didn't run at all last week. So you can't really guess or bet on him coming back.
Even without it.
You know, if you don't have him, you don't have Chancellor back. I mean, now you're starting to look at those kind of, well, if we are running at full strength versus their full strength, well, we're definitely not going to be running at full strength.
Well, they won't be either. I mean, the loss of Tyrann Mathieu is a huge deal, and they're down to their third running back. The crazy thing about the Cardinals is it hasn't mattered. David Johnson's been better than all of them.
Yeah.
And apparently, you know, I was worried. I thought one of the things that made the Cardinals' defense so good, and I don't think that this changes anything, is that you have a guy like Tyrann Mathieu, and you can play him everywhere, right? He lets you do whatever you want with the other 10 guys. He's your switchblade. They lost him. I was really curious to see what would happen going up against Aaron Rodgers, who, despite a down year, might still be the best quarterback in the world. And they thumped him. I mean, that defense
crazy,
dominated
man.
That game. Yeah. Like, it was a curb stomping. So, I think that we're going to see y'all remember where you were when you saw that scene, right? Yes. So that I'm like seeing that. Okay, the Cardinals aren't at full strength, but I think their backup strength runs stronger than the Seahawks one does right now.
Yeah.
Isaac, what are you expecting to see from this game?
Well, now a much more meaningful, enjoyable football game.
Mm-hmm.
And that's number one.
You enjoy football?
I do.
It's just something that makes us mad. So
I like the football. But
you enjoy
actually,
watching the Seahawks?
I do. Well, sometimes not as much, but other times, most of the time, I do. Yeah. So no, I think it'll be fun. I certainly think it'll be a better game than it was last week. I really do, and I sincerely hope they get some of their guys back. That would be nice.
They're actually. The Cardinals are favored by 6.5 right now, at least the composite is, yeah. Which is the biggest deficit for them since 2012.
That's amazing. I was just going to say.
Yeah.
I was going to say it has to have been.
That's the biggest. That's the biggest spread since they played at the 49ers in 2012.
Well, I think you're going to be able to see, and this is just obvious beyond obvious, but you're going to be able to really get an indicator of what the playoffs are looking like,
mm-hmm.
is how they're going to come out.
Yeah.
Not just how the whole game plays out, but if they're going to come out, if they're going to be able to stay on schedule with the offense, if the defense is going to be able to start getting any pressure at all on Palmer.
Yeah.
And, you know, you just kind of you wonder if they're going to actually end up sitting Michael Bennett, mm-hmm. because he said he was running at 70%. So there's so many variables, but the way they come out, if they have the fire, if they have that intensity, then you have the hope for the playoffs, win or lose versus the Cardinals. Whereas if they come out flat again like they did with the Rams, we're fucked.
My biggest wish for this game is no injuries.
Yeah.
That's my biggest wish for this game.
Sure.
I would like to see them not have a repeat of that first half against the Cardinals last game. Because
right.
that second half was very, very good.
Mm-hmm.
That first half was a monkey fucking a football out there.
But
it was awful.
I don't, you know, I don't think we're going to.
No, I don't either.
Come out.
I don't either.
Because they got embarrassed.
Yeah.
Against
this team, there's so much pride and there's so much talent and they're really good at what they do. That's not something that happens often for them.
Right.
But I think injuries are the biggest thing for them right now. Is whether Lynch plays or not, don't care. They need to come out of this, win or lose, as few and minor injuries as possible. Because there's a good possibility that they could be playing on Saturday of the following week, so they have an even shorter. And then they're flying to Minnesota, Green Bay, or Washington. And those aren't quick flights. So it's change of time zones, all of that. So the impetus for them is get through this game, perform as well as they can, because I love that Pete Carroll doesn't take games off. And let's get ourselves focused on the next week and going.
You know, the thing is with this team that is if they are – if they do have the fire, if they do have the magic, I love the idea of them having to go to Washington, Green Bay, Minnesota, because that gets that chip back on the shoulder, and that gets them as the underdog, and that's with the role that they play so well, especially if Lynch comes back in. It could be some great performances in the playoffs to see them angry again.
Yeah.
That it was an anger that was missing so badly last Sunday.
And there is something about playing on the road when it's you versus the 11 guys on the field and the 60,000 in the stands.
Yeah, and going to Lambeau, you know, it's a big FU.
The year we won the national championship at PLU.
Do you want to talk about PLU?
I think this has a little relevance. We played consecutive games on the playoffs in Oregon, Iowa, Minnesota, Texas, and then Virginia.
Wow.
So, five straight Saturdays on the road.
Wow. Right.
And there is nothing more enjoyable than we got nothing to lose. Screw it. We're the worst seed. We were literally the worst seed in the West Coast.
You got house money.
And it was like, screw it. Let's screw up these people's Thanksgivings. When we were in Iowa, it's like, let's fuck up these farm
school right now.
Yeah. It was so much better than real life. And when we would have playoff games at home, then it's like, your girlfriends are around and the people at school are there. And there's those same distractions on the professional level of, friends that are in town and all that. When you're on the road, you are away from it all. Like, it is you in a hotel room, and what are you going to do? Are you going to watch Glory on TV for the 80th time, or are you going to watch a little more
it's
film?
It's probably one of the best things that could happen to this team.
It's a huge...
especially if Marshawn gets back in the fold, is that you almost feel like the not silent captain, but the unofficial captain, it will be back, and then you've got your army back together, and you're going to go move forward, but you're not going to go move forward with the distractions that are happening.
To that point, Danny, I want to get your take on this. The coaches didn't seem super enthused about Marshawn Lynch's return. I mean, you read between the lines on Tom. You don't even have to read between the lines on Tom Cable's comments that it sounded like couldn't really give a crap one way or the other. And obviously, that's not to say that he has no value, but it wasn't the effusive praise that you would expect from a borderline Hall of Famer coming back for a playoff run, right? What's your take on that?
Well, I mean, I think for a while, you know, Lynch has been... I mean, he's been the engine that runs that offense for years, but at the same time, you know, he's... Like, he's flipping off Daryl Bevel during a game. His mom is, like cussing out Daryl Bevel, like, after a game. His agent is tweeting at Russell Wilson to pull his head out of his ass during a game. I mean, there's enough evidence out there and just rumors and stuff that you've heard that he is a little bit of a diva, like, behind the scenes. Mm-hmm. And I think that wears thin on them. And when Kibble is saying that they're riding a 5-game winning streak, their chemistry is as good as it can possibly be. They're having fun. They're really playing well. Russell Wilson owns that offense now. And I think what he was saying was, like, hey, if you're coming back... And the other thing is, like, it's weird because he's, like, off somewhere.
Yeah.
Doing his thing. This would be a bigger story if it wasn't Marshawn Lynch, but it's just so typical for him. Everyone's just like, whatever.
Mm-hmm.
Like, tell me if you're going to come back.
Yeah.
But, like, he's just, like, off and wherever.
And maybe you guys can answer this. Chuck Powell brought this up, I think it was there yesterday at KJR, that it wasn't just the social aspect of it, that the offense itself had changed from...
Right.
Just schematically, yeah.
Schematically.
Yeah.
So it wasn't as much as a social, dude, you're going to have to just toe the line, you're going to have to get your shit together, as much as this is actually how we're running it now.
Yeah, and I don't think with Marshawn there, it doesn't change. It doesn't make a drastic change in an offense from a wishbone to a run and shoot. I mean, it's still going to be a power running football team. They're doing some things differently, we don't know if Marshawn has been healthy all year, because the only glimmer we got of him coming off of some time off was the San Francisco
game.
And he had 9 carries in that first drive and ended up with 130 yards. He was a beast that game. He was making jump cuts in the hole that were Marshawn the previous years that are unbelievable. If he has been dealing with this all year, which probably has... We don't know.
Yeah,
we don't know where he's coming back.
He's been dealing with the hamstring.
Yeah.
And he's been...
And he had like 3 things going on.
Yeah. Yeah. If he is coming back and he's actually feeling good and ready to go and of the mindset of, you know what, I'm probably out of Seattle this year, but if somebody's going to pick me up and sign me for a couple-year deal, I got a couple-week audition to make millions of dollars.
Or if this is it.
Yeah.
I mean, he threatened to retire 2 years ago.
Yeah.
If he's, you know, if he says, okay, well... Enough is enough. I'm gonna call it at the end of this. These could be my last 1, 2, 3, 4, 5 games.
Yeah.
So, the thought, at least, you know, as we're sitting here as the couch psychologist, the thought is that he should come back ready, hungry, pissed as fuck, and ready to take down in the truest beast mode that we have not seen since last year.
Yeah.
We just need all the weapons we can get at this point.
Right.
So, and that's true.
Because if I'm a D coordinator getting ready to prepare for the Seahawks, right now I say, well, I need to contain Russell Wilson, not have to worry too much about the run, and make sure Tyler Lockett doesn't take off down the field and catch a long ball. And, you know, each one of those weapons we take away, the easier it gets to defend the offense. And so by bringing him back, even if he, whatever variation he comes back, as long as they can fit it all together and make it work, him even
they
just
being
there.
They don't even need to fit it all together. They need to almost he just needs to be there.
Absolutely. That's very fair.
And, and if he is there, all of a sudden, it just it changes the entire dynamic of how you're going to face the, the Seahawk offense. He could stand in the goddamn backfield and just go, oh.
Well, and the thing is when Marshawn is on the field, it has never been an effort thing where you're like, this guy just is giving up on the play or he's running out of bounds. I'm thinking back to when he flipped Bevel off on the sidelines on the pass play. He still blocked his ass off on that play. I mean, he was pissed as could be, and he probably would have had a touchdown, but he was still blocking his ass off. There's never been an effort on the field with Marshawn.
Right.
He gets paid to produce on Sundays, and he gets to be in his own Marshawn world Monday through Saturday and do whatever he does, whereas most people... You pay them for Monday through Saturday, and Sunday is for free because they like football. Marshawn's kind of that opposite of he gets to do his own thing, and we knew this getting him from Buffalo. This was not a new thing with Marshawn, that he was in his own little planetarium there. And on Sundays, he's just damn
good. It's crazy to have a guy that's just like, okay, I'm going to tap into being an all-pro running back for a few hours.
Yeah.
Which makes
like, I'm not going to practice.
He goes into this thing I like to call beast mode.
That's a great term.
That's catchy. I just remember, beast and I know it's training camp and whatever, but I went to training camp this year a couple of times, and Marshawn was, Brent just... begged. I literally tried to find anyone else. I put Craigslist, anybody but Brent. So I went down to training camp, some rando, and I was watching, and they're running their practice, and Marshawn Lynch is out there in sweats, and there's like the team will have a huddle, and he'll just like run in there and jump on Richard Sherman, and it's like it's funny and it's whatever, but it's like also, hey, like the defensive backs are talking about playing defensive back, and Marshawn Lynch is like, you know, grabbing Richard Sherman and stuff like
that. Hot dog?
Like it's what's that?
At practice, I heard that story too. Like he had stuck a couple hot dogs in his pocket.
See, that's just what I'm saying. He's like Marshawn Lynch.
Pocket dog.
Marshawn Lynch is the Manny Ramirez of the NFL. Ooh, like he's just he's just Marshawn's going to be Marshawn.
Yeah.
So we talk about this. We joke about blah blah blah. But there's a very real possibility that that is a missing piece that cannot be overstated. That once he is back, it's that missing thing that kind of key. Then you turn it, and the oh shit happens.
I think the absence of Rawls is bigger than the presence of Lynch. Honestly, I think the absence of Rawls is bigger than the presence of Lynch because we talked about it a few weeks ago when Rawls was still healthy and coming off a couple of monster games. Is that there's a huge difference. Blocking for a guy who's going to get there a step and a half quicker, right? When you only have to block for 1.5 seconds instead of 2 seconds, that's a huge difference.
But your tempo and your pace and everything is on the field, and I'm talking about in the locker room and him jumping on Richard Sherman. That,
but I feel like
an element of Lynch that maybe he's that key piece that right now that we need, especially after such a shit game that he can come in and go.
Danny, you think there's something to that? Do you think that it is important for Marshawn Lynch to be there for the offense to operate at their best?
It feels like he's universally loved by his teammates. And, you know, I'm talking about kind of with the coaching staff's view of, I think he's a little bit disruptive or whatever, and he has
most been. Popular kid in class.
Right, but I think his teammates absolutely love him. And you guys, I think, were talking about it last week, where you're talking about Emmitt Smith buying the Beamer keys.
Yeah.
They really love blocking from Marshawn.
Yeah.
That's something we've heard a lot.
Yep.
A guy like that who will like bounce off people, Plinko, like through the line, you know, like, you know, I think they really love that. And I think that could have, you know, on the field and off the field, I think he brings that element.
Well, I think the biggest thing for me, and I never know how much to read into off the field locker room stuff. It's not to say it doesn't matter. It obviously matters. We just can't say every locker room stuff.
It's all rumor. Right? Yep. We don't know.
Yep. Right. So, I think that what you get with Marshawn Lynch, if he's fully healthy or 90% of fully healthy, is you get your playbook back. Because Marshawn Lynch can block, and Marshawn Lynch can catch, and Marshawn Lynch can run every single play that you need him to do, and he can do it quarters 1 through 4.
Yeah.
And I think that's a big thing that they don't necessarily have on the roster.
If you go back to the Super Bowl of last year, so New England scores their final touchdown, goes up, Seattle gets the ball back. First play – Marshawn's out at wide receiver, split wide, and they what's a 24, 25 yard pass to him. He is great out of the backfield catching the ball, not just on screens and little swing routes, but on actual routes that wide receivers run.
If he plays Sunday, he will literally be the freshest guy on the field.
The other thing we haven't talked about, too, is our secondary for this game, if Cam is back, and even if he's not back, is different than the first game where we had Terry Williams out there without Jeremy Lane. And so now we're having Deshaun Shedd, Jeremy Lane, Sherman, Earl, possibly Cam, Kelsey McCray. That's a different group out there,
too. I thought the defense was pretty good. Did he get any sacks or turnovers, right? And that's a big part of it. Like, you do need turnovers. You need to make those plays. But at the same time, I mean, what, the Rams passed for 97 yards. They had 3.9 yards per play. 200 total yards.
You're not going to sack quarterbacks that run three-step drops every play.
Yeah.
You're just not. Yeah. Like, that's you try to get your hands up. You try to knock a ball down. The corners need to play up a little bit more to stop some of those quick routes. Seattle did what they could. If a team is going to just run that dink and dunk crap against them,
the Rams offense didn't win that game.
No.
The Rams offense
didn't win that game. And the Seahawks defense didn't lose that game.
Yep, I totally agree.
Well, then, you know, the big concern that the thing that I've been thinking about is that, okay, so who's next? Mm-hmm. Okay, we're going to get through this cards game whether we win or lose. What do we want to do? Are we looking forward to the Redskins, Green Bay, or
for
Minnesota?
For me, because it'll be a road game either way. Mm-hmm. Seahawks kick just the Vikings right in the nuts in their hometown. I have zero fear of the Vikings in Minnesota. I don't think that is a roster capable of making 29 points worth of adjustments. I just don't, and maybe I'll be proved wrong. For me, they're desired outcome number one. I thought the Redskins would be the easiest of the bunch, and I know they're beating bad teams and whatever, but confidence is a funny thing. And especially the way Kirk Cousins is going. Kirk Cousins has to just feel invincible right now. So I think they're kind of a scary team.
Yeah,
they're certainly
you can kneel instead of spike.
Sure, and still win a game. And that's the thing. He bounced back after just a total brain fart and had a great second half. The Packers are more talented than the Redskins. But you're talking about two teams passing each other going this way. And if they're anywhere close to each other, I'd rather play this team than this team. So for me, right now, I cannot believe I'm saying this, but I think Seattle's favored against all three teams. I do.
Yeah.
But I think the Redskins might be the best shot to beat them.
I'm sorry to, you know, jump right back in. But I do not want to.
Is that finger blast right there?
Yeah. Because that's what you do at a Russian bathhouse.
Russian bathhouse.
Yeah. But I do not want to go to Washington. The last time we played, guys' knees got torn up.
Yeah.
You know,
and RG3.
Yeah, RG3.
Hauschka too. Remember they had to pull a kicker for the second round.
Though in theory they could beat us, but they've got the weaker record. But it's a field I just don't want to go to, and for some reason, just a gut feeling, I would actually rather go to the Packers. I'd rather go to Lambeau.
Yeah, I think the Redskins.
Go,
Danny. How would you? You write on teams across the NFL. You're contractually obligated to know a little bit about these teams,
or at least pretend to.
Who do you think the Seahawks match up best against?
Okay, so I think I agree with you that the ideal situation would probably actually be to go to Minnesota, which would mean, I don't even know, they would end up the 6th seed, and then Minnesota would win the NFC.
Yep,
so
yep.
Seahawks lose, Minnesota wins next week, I think would maybe actually be the ideal. But in terms of just the playoff matchups, because, again, like we talked about this on the Deep Balls podcast, like they just match up well against Minnesota. I think that they can take Adrian Peterson out of the game and make them one-dimensional. And is Teddy Bridgewater going to beat you right now? Like, he's been playing better, but I don't think so. No. Now, on the other hand, Washington's playing really well, too. But there's strength of schedule things going there. They have zero run game. So is Kirk Cousins going to beat the Seahawks I don't know. I think, to me, I think the order would be Minnesota, I think, would be the best matchup. Washington would be the second best. I don't want to go to Lambeau.
Sure.
I don't like going to Lambeau.
Sure, Aaron Rodgers and Lambeau is still Aaron Rodgers and Lambeau. Yeah, I get that.
To be clear, it is an irrational thought to want to go right. to Green Bay.
Right.
But there's just...
But they have been bad lately.
Yeah. As I said a couple times in this podcast, they just got their ass kicked.
Hard.
It's a team that I think that we can beat. And there's just something about Lambeau that the Hawks, I believe... We go to Washington, you go to Minnesota, okay, the stadiums, the whatever. You go to Lambeau, that's sacred ground, that's hollow ground. And you there's that little extra, that 5%, the 3%, where it is, we're going to be the Packers in Lambeau.
And the Bears tend to get up for games like that.
Exactly. Yeah. That's why I think that's the best one. Because it's the hardest. And I think that's where they actually excel, is when it's the hardest.
For me, it would be Minnesota 1, followed by Washington, a close 2. I have no desire to go to Lambeau because of Aaron fucking Rodgers.
Yeah. Right.
Honestly. Because a quarterback on a hot day can beat any defense, and it doesn't matter how good your defense is, and they can be without Jordy Nelson, and Seattle can shut down their run game, and somehow they will figure out how to get 3 touchdown passes or 4 touchdown passes, and Aaron Rodgers can put a ball... He could drop a football literally in this stein of beer from 40 yards away, and there's nothing that a cornerback or a safety can do because he has that good of ball placement. Aaron Rodgers terrifies me, and I remember back to when we were talking about last year, Dallas or Green Bay in the playoffs, and we were doing the podcast, and I said, I would much rather face Dallas. I don't want to see Aaron Rodgers because him on a hot day is still the best quarterback on the face of this earth.
No doubt.
And he can do shit that nobody else can do.
But
they are a distant 3 for me because of that one human being. If he tears his ACL this weekend, let's go to Green Bay. Let's go there.
Give me Russell Wilson on his best day versus Aaron Rodgers on his best day.
Rodgers.
Aaron Rodgers is a better quarterback.
It's a better quarterback, but you're no longer...
Seahawks on their best day versus Packers on their best day, I'll take the Hawks.
Right.
But if we're talking Aaron Rodgers versus Russell Wilson on their best day, I will take Aaron Rodgers... Every day of the week.
Who are you rooting for, Isaac? Who do you want to see them play?
Cleveland Browns.
You're the one getting Manziel drunk.
He plays better with a higher blood alcohol content.
I agree.
He's a functioning drunk.
Is that not my option? I can't choose Cleveland? No.
I don't think so.
I'm also in the camp of Minnesota. I'd like to. If I had to choose one, I'd say Minnesota just because I think we can contain. It's going to be hard because they played them. Anytime you play a team a second time, it's much more challenging. That was their, we just had our nightmarish worst case scenario. We were there, nightmarish. It's not going to be that bad, but from what they bring against us, I think that's probably
but the best. But be answer. Careful what you wish for.
I know. Isn't that the way?
Yeah.
It's the playoffs. You're going to have to win hard
games.
Yeah. And you're going to have to win 3 to get to the Super Bowl, so.
If we can effectively take away Adrian Peterson, I would rather have Teddy Bridgewater try and beat me than anybody else.
Yeah, I hear that.
I'd say Kirk Cousins can do some stuff. Aaron Rodgers is Aaron Rodgers, but if I can make Teddy Bridgewater.
I'll say this, man. If the Seahawks do make it to the Super Bowl with this draw against this NFC, that is a freaking accomplishment. I mean, that is like they've had the deck stacked in their favor the last couple of years, winning home field and having home field be the biggest home field advantage in the NFL. This is not going to be that in any way, shape, or form. This is going to have to be winning a game that they're probably very slightly favored in, and then pulling 2 upsets.
Yeah. See, I think that's where they're going to be at the best.
Yeah.
I really do. I could be proven wrong in 2 weeks. I could be, I would totally miss the boat. But this is what the team needs right now, and maybe that was part of what we just saw with the Rams, is that they don't have that hunger because something more difficult isn't on the line.
Yeah.
This is – they're going to go. They're going to play the Cardinals. It's going to be a hell of a battle, and then shit's going to get real. And you're going to have Marshawn, and you're going to have all these factors in. And I think this year's team needs shit to get real. They need.
Like they almost need the conflict.
Yeah, they do. They need the conflict. They need the toughness. They need the Doug Baldwin to get super pissed. They need Curse to be there. They need, you know, Lockett. Yeah. They need Wilson's focus, and they need Marshawn thinking, I've got to make another Super Bowl.
When was the last time they were underdogs going into
right? This is it. Yeah. That's exactly it. I think psychologically, this team needs to get pissed.
The thing about the playoffs is the best teams typically don't win the Super Bowl, right? Like, I mean, sometimes they do, but like most of the time, the playoffs are weird.
Yeah,
yeah,
like, it's a new season. It's a new season, start from scratch.
And what's the? I mean, honestly, what's the talent differential between 1%, the one seed and the four seed?
Nothing.
Or whatever.
One to six, they are really close.
Yeah. It's not like I mean, they're ups. When you think about a six seed beating a three seed or a 5 seed beating a 1 seed later in the playoffs, or whatever, seems like a huge upset because you're only thinking of it in terms of a 6-team structure. But if you think about it in terms of a 16-team structure, all of a sudden,
just beat a good team.
Yeah, a good team beat a better team, and that's the thing that happens. So we're gonna have a lot to talk about next week. Things are gonna be really real. We know the Seahawks are gonna be in the playoffs.
For so long, this was a hell of a podcast.
Yeah,
and so. We'll see exactly how this shakes out with the Cardinals. I want to say thank you to the Glow Nightclub here in downtown Bellingham for hosting us. I want to say thank you to Joel Litwin for making us look and sound so good. Isaac, Matt, Danny, Brent, appreciate you guys being here, and we'll catch you next week.